Pontifex. By the time Randy reaches the Air Kinakuta boarding lounge, he has already forgotten how he reached the airport. He honestly can't remember. Did he hail a taxi? Not likely in downtown Los Altos. Did he get a ride from some hacker? He couldn't have driven the Acura because the Acura's electronics had been burned to a crisp by the electromagnetic pulse gun. He had pulled the title out of the glove compartment and signed it over to a Ford dealer 3 blocks away in exchange for $5,000 in cash. Oh, yeah, the Ford dealer gave him a ride to the airport. He has always wanted to pull the stunt of walking up to the counter of an exotic foreign airline and saying, "Get me on the next plane to X." But now he's just done it, and it wasn't cool and romantic as he had hoped. It was sort of bleak and stressful and expensive. He had to buy a first-class ticket, which consumed most of the $5,000, but he doesn't feel like beating himself to death over how he is managing his assets just now. That is, at a time when his net worth is a negative number that can only be expressed by using scientific notation. The probability is high that he failed to wipe Tombstone's hard drive before the cops seized it, and that the dentist's lawsuit will consequently succeed. On his way down the concourse, he stands and stares at a bank of telephones for a while. He very much wants to notify the Shaftos of recent events. It would be a good thing if they could somehow strip the sunken club clean of treasure as fast as possible, reducing its value and hence the damage that the dentist can inflict on Epiphyte. The math is pretty simple here. The dentist has a way to claim damages from Epiphyte. The amount of those damages is X, where X is what the dentist, as a minority shareholder, would have made in capital gains if Randy had been responsible enough to write a better contract with Semper Marine. If such a contract had specified a 50-50 split, then X would be equal to 50% of the cash value of the wreck, times the 1/10 of Epiphyte that the dentist owns, minus a few percent for taxes and other frictional effects of the real world. So if there's $10 million in the wreck, then X works out to around $500,000. In order for the dentist to gain control of Epiphyte, he has to acquire an additional 40% of its stock. The price of that stock, if it were for sale, is simply 0.4 times the total value of Epiphyte. Call it Y. If X is greater than Y, the dentist wins, because then the judge is going to say, "You, Epiphyte, owe this poor aggrieved minority shareholder X dollars. But as I look at the parlous state of the corporation's finances, I see that there is no way for you to raise that kind of money. And so the only way to settle the debt is to give the plaintiff the one asset you have in abundance, which is your crappy stock. And since the value of the whole corporation is really, really close to being zero, you're going to have to give him almost all of it." So how to make X less than Y? Either reduce the value of the wreck by stripping it of its gold, or else increase the value of Epiphyte by... what exactly? In better times, they could maybe take the company public, but setting up an IPO takes months, and no investor's going to touch it when it's encumbered by a lawsuit from the dentist. Randy has this vision of driving through the jungle with an end loader and scooping up that big pile of gold bars he found with Doug and taking it straight to a bank and depositing it in Epiphyte's account. That'd do it. The whole concept makes his body tingle as he stands there in the middle of the international concourse. Off to the left, some kind of huddled or teeming mass, heavy on the women and children, passes, and Randy hears some familiar voices. His mind has wrapped itself like a starving squid around this gold-in-the-jungle concept, and in order to address reality for just a second, he has to peel the tentacles away, popping those suckers off of it one by one. He eventually focuses in on the scuttling group and identifies it as Avi's family. Devra and a bunch of kids and the two nannies, clutching passports and tickets in LL jackets. The kids are small and prone to sudden darting tactics. The adults are tense and not inclined to let them stray. So the group's movement down the concourse has the general aspect of a pack of beagles heading in the approximate direction of some fresh meat. Randy is probably personally responsible for this exodus, and would much rather slink into the men's room and crawl down a toilet. But he has to say something. So he catches up with Devra and startles her by offering to carry the child support bag that she has slung over her shoulder. This turns out to be shockingly heavy. Several gallons of apple juice, he would estimate, plus complete asthma attack management infrastructure, and maybe a few bricks of solid gold, in case of some totalizing civil breakdown en route. So, going to Israel?
El Al doesn't fly to Acapulco.
Pow! Devorah is in peak form.
Did Avi give you any kind of rationale for this?
You're asking me? I kind of assumed you would know, Devorah says.
Well, things have been certainly volatile, Randy says. I don't know if fleeing the country is warranted.
Then why are you in the airport with an Air Kinakuta ticket sticking out of your pocket?
Well, you know, some business issues need resolving.
You seem really depressed. Do you have a problem?
Devorah asks. Randy sighs. Well, that depends. Do you?
Do I what? Have a problem? Why should I have a problem?
Because you've been uprooted and sent packing on 10 minutes' notice.
We're going to Israel, Randy. That's not being uprooted. That's being rerouted.
Or perhaps she is saying rerouted. Without a transcript, there is no way for Randy to tell.
Yeah, but it's still kind of a hassle.
Compared to what?
Well, compared to staying at home and living your life.
This is my life, Randy.
Devorah is definitely kicking out a prickly vibe here. Randy figures that she is incredibly pissed off, but under some kind of emotional non-disclosure agreement. This is probably better than the only other two alternatives Randy can think of, namely, 1, dissolving into hysterical recriminations, and 2, beatific serenity. It is an I'll do my job, you do yours, why are you in my face attitude. Randy feels like an idiot all of a sudden for having taken Devorah's bag. She is clearly just this side of aghast, wondering why the fuck Randy is toiling as a skycap at this critical moment. Like she and the nannies are not capable of humping a sack down a hallway. Has she, Devorah, offered to step in and help Randy write any code lately? And if Randy really has nothing better to do, why doesn't he be a man and strap grenades all over his body and give the dentist a big hug? Randy says,
I assume you'll be in touch with Avi before you take off. Would you give him a message?
What's the message?
0.
That's it?
That's it, Randy says.
Devorah is perhaps not familiar with Randy and Avi's practice of conserving precious bandwidth by communicating in binary code, one bit at a time, a la Paul Revere in the Old North Church. In this case, 0 means that Randy did not succeed in wiping out all the data on Tombstone's hard drive. Air Kinakuta's first-class lounge, with its free drinks and highly un-American concept of service, beckons. Randy avoids it because he knows he will sink straight into a coma if he goes there, and they would have to load him onto the 747 with a forklift. Instead, he walks around the airport, clutching his hip spastically every time he re-realizes that his laptop isn't dangling there. He is not adjusting very quickly to the fact that most of the laptop is stuffed into a wastebasket at the Ford dealership where he unloaded the Acura. While he was waiting for his man to scurry back from the bank with the $5,000, he used the screwdriver attachments on his multipurpose pocket tool to extract the laptop's hard drive, and then threw away the rest. Very large television sets hang from the ceilings in the departure lounge, showing the airport channel, which is a parade of news bits even more punishingly flimsy than normal television news, mixed in with a great deal of weather and stock quotes. Randy is struck, but not precisely surprised, to see footage of black-hatted secret admirers exercising their Second Amendment rights in the streets of Los Altos, and of Ordo's barricade avalanching towards the camera, and the police storming over it, weapons drawn. Paul Comstock is shown, pausing as he climbs into a limousine to say something, looking hale and smug. The conventional wisdom about TV news is that the image is everything, and if that is the case, then this is a big win for Ordo, which looks like the victim of jackbooted thugs. Which gets epiphyte nowhere, since Ordo is, or ought to be, nothing more than a bystander. This is supposed to be a private conflict between the dentist and Epiphyte, and now it's become a public one between Comstock and Ordo, and this makes Randy irritated and confused. He goes and gets on his plane and starts eating caviar. Normally he doesn't partake, but caviar has a decadent fiddling while Rome burns thing going for it that works for him just now. As is his nerdly custom, Randy actually reads the informational cards that are stuffed in among the in-flight magazines and vomit sacks. One of these extols the fact that Sultan-class passengers, as first-class passengers are called, can not only make outgoing phone calls from their seats, but can also receive incoming ones. So Randy dials the number for Douglas MacArthur Shafto's GSM telephone. It's an Australian phone number, but it'll ring anywhere on the planet. Right now, it's something like 6 a.m. in the Philippines, but Doug is bound to be awake, and indeed, he answers his phone on the second ring. Randy can tell from the sound of horns and diesels that he is stuck in Manila traffic, probably in the back of a taxi.
"It's Randy, on a plane," says Randy. "An Air Kinakuta plane."
"Randy, well, I've just been watching you on television," Doug says.
It takes a minute for that to sink in. Randy has used a couple of vodkas to cleanse his palate of the caviar.
"Yeah," Doug continues. "I turned on CNN when I woke up and glimpsed you sitting on top of a car typing. What's going on?"
"Nothing. Nothing at all," Randy says.
He figures that this is a big stroke of luck. Now that Doug has seen him on CNN, he'll be more likely to affect superbly dramatic measures out of sheer paranoia. Randy slurps vodka and says, "Wow, this Sultan-class service is great. Anyway, if you do a web search on Ordo, you'll see this nonsense has absolutely nothing to do with us. Nothing."
"That's funny, because Comstock is denying that it's a crackdown on Ordo," Doug says.
When speaking of official U.S. government denials, Vietnam combat veterans like Doug are capable of summoning up a drawling irony that is about as subtle as having automotive jumper cables connected directly to your fillings, but much funnier. Vodka climbs about halfway up Randy's nose before he controls it.
"They say that is just a little old civil suit," Doug says, now using a petal-soft, wounded, innocent tone.
"Ordo's status as purveyor of stuff that the government hates and fears is just coincidental," Randy guesses.
"That's right."
"Well, then, I'm sure there's nothing to it other than our troubles with the dentist," Randy says.
"What troubles are those, Randy?"
"Happened during the middle of the night, your time. I'm sure you will have some interesting faxes awaiting you this morning."
"Well, maybe I should look at those faxes then,"
Doug Shafto says.
"Maybe I'll give you a buzz when I reach Kinakuta," Randy says.
"You have a good flight, Randall."
"Have a nice day, Douglas."
Randy puts the phone back in his armrest cradle and prepares to sink into a well-deserved plane coma. But 5 minutes later, the phone rings. It's so disorienting to have one's phone ring on an airplane that he doesn't know what to make of it for a while. When he finally realizes what's going on, he has to consult the instruction card to figure out how to answer it. When he finally has the thing turned on and at his ear, a voice says,
"You call that subtle? You think that you and Doug Shafto are the only two people in the world who know that Sultan-class passengers can receive incoming phone calls?"
Randy is certain he's never heard this voice before. It is the voice of an old man. Not a voice worn out or cracking with age, but a voice that's been slowly worn smooth, like the steps of a cathedral.
Who's this?
"Am I right in thinking that you want Mr. Shafto to go to a paid telephone somewhere and then call you back?"
"Who is this, please?"
"You think that's more secure than his GSM phone? It's not really."
The speaker pauses frequently before, during, and after sentences, as if he's been spending a lot of time alone and is having trouble hitting his conversational stride.
"Okay," Randy says. "You know who I am and whom I was calling, so obviously you are surveilling me. You're not working for the dentist, I take it. That leaves,
what, the United States government? The NSA, right?" The man laughs.
"As a rule, The Fort Meade boys don't bother to check in with the people whose lines they are tapping.
The caller has an un-American crispness in his voice, vaguely Northern European.
In your case, the NSA might make an exception, it's true. When I was there, they were all great admirers of your grandfather's work. In fact, they liked it so much, they stole it.
No higher flattery, I guess.
You should be a billionaire, Randy. Thank God you're not.
Why do you say that?
Oh, because then you'd be a highly intelligent man who never has to make difficult choices, who never has to exert his mind. It is a state much worse than being a moron.
Did Grandpa work for you at the NSA?
He wasn't interested. Said he had a higher calling. So while he made better and better computers to solve the Harvard Waterhouse Prime Factor Challenge, my friends at the NSA watched him and learned.
And you did too.
I? Oh, no. I have only modest skills with a soldering iron. I was there to watch the NSA watching your grandfather.
On behalf of whom? Don't tell me. Eruditorum.org?
Well done, Randy.
What should I call you? Root? Pontifex?
Pontifex is a nice word.
It's true, Randy says. I checked it out, looking for clues in the etymology. It's an old Latin word meaning priest.
Catholics call the Pope Pontifex Maximus, or Pontiff for short,
says Pontifex agreeably.
But the word was also used by pagans to denote their priests and Jews their rabbis. It is ever so ecumenical.
But the literal meaning of the word is bridge builder, and so it's a good name for a crypto system, Randy says.
Or, I hope, for me,
Pontifex says dryly.
I am glad you feel that way, Randy. Many people would think of a crypto system as a wall rather than a bridge.
Well, gosh, it's nice to telephonically meet you, Pontifex.
The pleasure is mutual.
You've been so quiet on the email front recently.
Didn't want to give you the creeps. I was afraid if I bothered you any more, you'd think I was proselytizing.
Not at all. By the way, people in the know think your cryptosystem is weird but good.
It's not weird at all, once you understand it,
Pontifex says politely.
Well, what occasions this phone call? Obviously, your friends are still surveilling me on behalf of,
whom exactly?
I don't even know, Pontifex says. But I do know that you're trying to crack Arethusa.
Randy cannot even remember ever uttering the word Arethusa. It was printed on the wrappers on the bricks of ETC cards that he ran through Chester's card reader. Now Randy pictures a box inside Grandpa's old trunk labeled Harvard Waterhouse Prime Factor Challenge and dated in the early 1950s. So that at least gives him a date to peg on Pontifex.
You were at NSA during the late 40s and early 50s, Randy says. You must have worked on Harvest.
Harvest was a legendary code-breaking supercomputer 3 decades ahead of its time, built by ETC engineers working under an NSA contract.
I told you, Pontifex says. Your grandfather's work came in handy.
Chester's got this retired ETC engineer working on his card machinery, Randy says. He helped me read the Arethusa cards, saw the wrappers. He's a friend of yours. He called you.
Pontifex chuckles.
Among our little band, there is hardly a word with more memories attached to it than Arethusa. He nearly hit the floor when he saw it. Called me from the cell phone on his boat, Randy.
Why? Why was Arethusa such a big deal?
Because we spent 10 years of our lives trying to break the damned code. And we failed.
It must have been really frustrating, Randy says.
You still sound angry. I'm angry at Comstock. Not the Attorney General Paul Comstock. His father, Earl Comstock.
What? The guy that Doug Shafto threw off the ski lift? The Vietnam guy?
No. I mean, yes. Earl Comstock was largely responsible for our Vietnam policy. And Doug Shafto did get his 15 minutes of fame by throwing him off a ski lift in, I believe, 1979. But all of that Vietnam nonsense was just a coda to his real career.
Which was?
Earl Comstock, to whom your grandfather reported in Brisbane during World War II, was one of the founders of the NSA, and he was my boss from 1949 through about 1960. He was obsessed with Arethusa.
Why?
He was convinced it was a communist cipher, that if we could break it, we could then exploit that break to get into some later Soviet codes that were giving us difficulty. Which was ridiculous. But he believed it, or claimed to, and so we battered our heads against Arethusa for years. Strong men had nervous breakdowns. Brilliant men concluded that they were stupid. In the end, it turned out to be a joke.
A joke? What do you mean by that?
We ran those intercepts through Harvest backwards and forwards. The lights dimmed in Washington and Baltimore, we used to say, when we were doing Arethusa work. I still have the opening groups memorized. AADAA, FGTAA, and so on. Those double A's. People wrote dissertations about their significance. We concluded in the end that they were just flukes. We invented entire new systems of cryptanalysis to attack it, wrote new volumes of the Cryptonomicon. The data were very nearly random. Finding patterns in them was like trying to read a book that had been burned and its ashes mixed with all the cement that went into the Hoover Dam. We never got anything that was worth a damn. After 10 years or so, we began using it to haze incoming recruits. By that time, the NSA was getting fantastically huge. We were hiring all of the most brilliant math prodigies in the United States, and when we got one who was especially cocky, we'd put him on the Arethusa Project, just to give him the message that he wasn't as smart as he thought he was. We broke a lot of kids on that wheel. But then, around 1959, this one kid came in, the smartest kid we had seen yet, and he broke it.
Well, I assume you didn't place this phone call just to keep me in suspense, Randy says. What did he find?
He found that the Arethusa intercepts did not represent coded messages at all. They were simply the output of a particular mathematical function, a Riemann zeta function, which has many uses, one being that it is used in some cryptosystems as a random number generator. He proved that if you set up this function in a particular way and then gave it as input a particular string of numbers, it would crank out the exact sequence that was on those intercepts. So that was all she wrote. And it almost ended Comstock's career.
Why?
Partly because of the insane amount of money and manpower he had thrown into the Arethusa Project, but mostly because the input string, the seed for the random number generator, was the boss's name, C-O-M-S-T-O-C-K.
You're kidding.
We had the proof right there. It was impeccable from a pure math standpoint. So, either Comstock had generated the Arethusa intercepts himself and been stupid enough to use his own name as the seed, and believe me, he really was that kind of guy, or someone else had played an enormous practical joke on him.
Which do you think it was?
Well, he never divulged where he had gotten these intercepts in the first place, and so it was difficult to form a hypothesis. I am inclined toward the joke theory because he was the sort of man who gives his subordinates a powerful urge to play practical jokes on him. But in the end, it didn't matter. He was drummed out of the NSA at the age of 46. A classic gray man, a war veteran, a technocrat with a high security clearance, and any number of high-powered connections. He went, more or less, straight to Kennedy's National Security Council from there, and the rest is history.
Wow, Randy says. Kind of odd. What a jerk.
No kidding, says Pontifex. And now his son... Well, don't get me started on his son.
As Pontifex's voice trails off, Randy asks,
So you are calling me now for what purpose?
Pontifex doesn't answer for a few moments, as if he's wrestling with the question himself. But Randy doubts that's the case. Someone is trying to send you a message.
I suppose that I am just appalled by the very idea of more young, bright men throwing themselves against Arethusa. Until I received that call from a boat on Lake Washington, I had thought it was dead and buried.
But why should you care?
You've already been cheated out of a fortune in computer patents, Pontifex says. It wouldn't be fair.
So it's pity, then.
Furthermore, as I said, it is my friend's job to keep you under surveillance. He's going to hear almost every word you say for the next few months, or at least read transcripts. For you and Cantrell and those others to spend that entire time yammering about Arethusa would be more than he could bear. Hideous deja vu. Just intolerably Kafkaesque. So please, just let it go.
Well, thanks for the tip.
You're welcome, Randy. And may I give you a word of advice?
That's what Pontifex is supposed to do.
First, a disclaimer. I've been out of circulation for a while. Have not picked up the postmodern unwillingness to make value judgments.
Okay, I'm bracing myself.
My advice, do try to build the best crypt you possibly can. Your clients, some of them anyway, are, for all practical purposes, aborigines. They will either make you rich or kill you, like something straight out of a Joseph Campbell footnote.
So you're talking about your basic Colombian drug lord types here?
Yes, I am, but I'm also referring to certain white men in suits. It only takes a single generation to revert to savagery.
Well, we provide state-of-the-art cryptographic services to all of our clients, even the ones with bones in their noses.
Excellent! And now, as much as I hate to sign off on a dark note, I must say goodbye.
Randy hangs up, and the phone rings again almost immediately.
Who the fuck are you?
Doug Shafto says.
I call you on the airplane and I get a busy signal?
I have a funny story to tell you, Randy says, about a guy you ran into once while skiing. But unfortunately, it will have to wait.
Glory. Bare-chested, camouflage-painted, trench knife in hand, Colt 45 stuck in the waistband of his khaki trousers, Bobby Shafto moves like a cloud of mist through the jungle. He stops when he can get a clear view of the NIP Army truck,
framed between the hairy, cluttered trunks of a couple of date palms. A skirmish line of ants crawls over the skin of his sandaled foot. He ignores them. It has all the earmarks of a piss stop. Two Nipponese privates climb out of the truck and confer for a few moments. One of them wades into the jungle. The other leans against the truck's fender and lights up a cigarette. Its glowing tip echoes the light of the sunset behind him. The one in the jungle drops his trousers, squats, leans back against a tree to take a shit. At this moment, they are supremely vulnerable. The contrast between the brightness of the sunset and the dimness of the jungle renders them nearly blind. The shitter is helpless, and the smoker looks exhausted. Bobby Shafto sheds his sandals. He emerges from the jungle onto the road behind the truck, strides forward on ant-bitten feet, crouches behind the truck's bumper. The weapon comes out of his hip pocket silently. Without taking his eyes off the smoker's feet, visible beneath the truck's chassis, he peels away the backing and slaps the payload onto the truck's tailgate. Then, just to rub it in, he slaps up another one. Mission accomplished. Take that, Tojo. Moments later, he's back in the jungle, watching as the Nip truck drives away, now sporting two red, white, and blue stickers reading, "I Shall Return." Bobby congratulates himself on another successful mission. Long after dark, he reaches the Hukbalahop camp up on the volcano. He works his way in through the booby-trapped perimeter and makes plenty of noise as he approaches, so that the Hook sentries won't shoot at him in the darkness. But he needn't have bothered. Discipline has broken down. They are all drunk and getting drunker because of something they heard on the radio. MacArthur has returned. The general has landed on Leyte. Bobby Shafto's response is to boil up some powerful coffee and begin pouring it into their signal man, Pedro. While the caffeine works its magic, Shafto grabs a message pad and the stub of a pencil and writes out his idea for the seventh time. Opportunity exists to contact and supply Phil-American elements in Concepcion. Stop. Volunteer for same. Stop. Await instructions. Stop. Signed, Shafto. He gets Pedro to encrypt it and send it off. After that, all he can do is wait and pray. This shit with the stickers has to stop. He has been tempted 1,000 times to desert and to go into Concepcion himself. Just because he's out in the boondocks with a band of Hook irregulars doesn't mean he's beyond the reach of military discipline. Deserters can still get shot or hanged, and despite the fact that he was one in Sweden, Bobby Shafto believes that they deserve to be. Concepcion is down in the lowlands, north of Manila. From the high places of the Zambales Mountains, you can actually see the town lying amid the green rice paddies. Those lowlands are still totally Nip-controlled, but when the general lands, he's probably going to land north of here at Lingayen Gulf, just like the Nips did when they invaded in 41, and then Concepcion is going to lie right in the middle of his route to Manila. He's going to need eyes there. Sure enough, the order comes through a couple of days later. Rendezvous Tarpon, Point Green, 5 November, stop. Convey transmitter Concepcion, stop. Await further orders, stop. Tarpon is the submarine that has been bringing them ammunition, medical supplies, I Shall Return stickers, cartons of American cigarettes with I Shall Return inserts in each pack, I Shall Return matchbooks, I Shall Return coasters, and I Shall Return condoms. Shafto has been stockpiling the condoms because he knows they won't go over well in a Catholic country. He knows that when he finds glory, he'll go through a long ton of condoms in about a week. 3 days later, he and a squad of Hooks are on hand to meet Tarpon at Point Green, which is their code name for a tiny cove on the west coast of Luzon, down beneath Mount Pinatubo, not all that far north of Subic Bay. The submarine glides in at around midnight, running on its electric motors so it won't make any sound, and the Hooks pull up alongside in rubber boats and outrigger canoes and unload the cargo. Sure enough, the transmitter's there. And this time, there's none of those goddamn stickers or matchbooks. The cargo is ammunition and a few fighting men, some Phil-American commandos fresh from a debriefing with MacArthur's intelligence chief, and a couple of Americans, MacArthur's advance scouts. Over the next several days, Shafto and a few hand-picked hooks carry the transmitter up one slope of the Zambales Mountains and down the other. They stop when the foothills finally give way to low-lying paddy land. The main north-south road from Manila up towards Lingayen Gulf lies directly across their path. After a few days of scrambling and scrounging, they are able to load the transmitter on board a farm cart and bury it in manure. They harness the cart to a pathetic carabao, loaned by a loyal but poor farmer, and set out across Nip Country, headed for Concepcion. At this point, they have to split up, though, because there's no way that blue-eyed Shafto can travel in the open. Two hooks, pretending to be farm boys, take the manure cart while Shafto begins making his way cross-country, traveling at night, sleeping in ditches or in the homes of trusted American sympathizers. It takes him a week and a half to cover the 50 kilometers, but in time, with patience and perseverance, he reaches the town of Concepcion and knocks on the door of their local contact around midnight. The contact is a prominent local citizen, the manager of the town's only bank. Mr. Calagua is astonished to see an American standing at his back door. This tells Shafto that something must have gone wrong. The boys with the transmitter should have arrived a week ago. But the manager tells him that no one has shown up, though rumor has it that the Nips recently caught some boys trying to smuggle contraband in a farm cart and executed them on the spot. So Shafto is marooned in Concepcion with no way to get orders or to send messages. He feels bad for the boys who died, but, in a way, this isn't such a bad situation for him. The only reason he wanted to be in Concepcion is that the Altamira family comes from here. Half of the local farmers are related to Glory in some way. Shafto breaks into the Calagua stables and improvises a bed. They would put him up in a spare bedroom if he asked, but he tells them that the stables are safer. If he gets caught, the Calaguas can at least claim ignorance. He recuperates on a pile of straw for a day or two, then starts trying to learn something about the Altamiras. He can't go out nosing around by himself, but the Calaguas know everyone in town, and they have a good sense of who can be trusted. So inquiries go out, and within a couple of days, information has come back in. Mr. Calagua explains to him over glasses of bourbon in his study. Racked by guilt over the fact that his honored guest is sleeping on a pile of hay in an outbuilding, he pushes bourbon at him all the time, which is fine with Bobby Shafto.
Some of the information is reliable. Some is, far-fetched, Mr. Calagua says. Here is the reliable part. First of all, your guess was correct. When the Japanese took over Manila, many members of the Altamira family came back to this area to stay with relatives. They believed it would be safer.
Are you telling me Glory is up here?
No, Mr. Calagua says sadly. She is not up here. But she was definitely here on September 13, 1942.
How do you know?
Because she gave birth to a baby boy on that day. The birth certificate is on file at the town hall. Douglas MacArthur Shafto.
Well, I'll be fucked sideways,
Shafto says. He starts calculating dates in his head.
Many of the Altamiras who fled here have since gone back to the city, supposedly to obtain work. But some of them are also serving as eyes and ears for the resistance.
I knew they would do the right thing,
Shafto says. Mr. Calagua smiles cautiously.
Manila is full of people who claim to be the eyes and ears of the resistance. It is easy to be eyes and ears. It is harder to be fists and feet. But some of the Altamiras are fighting, too. They have gone into the mountains to join the hooks.
Which mountains? I didn't run across any of them up in the Zambales.
South of Manila and Laguna Dabai are many volcanoes and heavy jungle. This is where some of Glory's family are fighting.
Is that where Glory is? And the baby? Or are they in the city?
Mr. Calagua is nervous.
This is the part that may be far-fetched. It is said that Glory is a famous heroine of the fight against the Nips.
Are you telling me she's dead? If she's dead, just tell me.
No, I have no information that she is dead. But she is a heroine. This is for certain.
The next day, Bobby Shafto's malaria comes back and keeps him laid up for about a week. The Calaguas move him right into their house and bring in the town doctor to look after him. It's the same doctor who delivered Douglas MacArthur Shafto 2 years ago. When he's feeling a little stronger, he lights out for the south. It takes him 3 weeks to reach the northern outskirts of Manila, hitching rides on trains and trucks, or sloshing through paddies in the middle of the night. He kills 2 Nipponese soldiers stealthily, and 3 of them in a firefight at an intersection. Each time he has to go to ground for a few days to avoid capture, but get to Manila he does. He can't go into the heart of the city. In addition to being really stupid, it would just slow him down. Instead, he skirts it, taking advantage of the thriving resistance network. He is passed from one barangay to the next, all the way around the outskirts of Manila, until he has reached the coastal plain between Laguna Dabai and Manila Bay. At this point, nothing is left to the south except for a few miles of rice paddies, and then the volcanic mountains where Altamiras are making names for themselves as guerrilla fighters. During his trip, he has heard 1,000 rumors about them. Most of them are patently false, people telling him what he obviously wants to hear, but several times he has heard what sounds like a genuine scrap of information about Glory. They say that she has a healthy young son, living in the apartment in the Malate neighborhood of Manila, being cared for by the extended family while his mother serves in the war. They say that she has put her nursing skills to work, acting as a sort of Florence Nightingale for the Hooks. They say that she is a messenger for the Phil-American forces, that no one surpasses her daring in crossing through Nipponese checkpoints carrying secret messages and other contraband. The last part doesn't make much sense to Shafto. Which is she? A nurse or a messenger? Maybe they have her confused with someone else. Or maybe she's both. Maybe she's smuggling medicine through the checkpoints. The farther south he gets, the more information he hears. The same rumors and anecdotes pop up over and over again, differing only in their small details. He runs into 6 people who are dead certain that Glory is south of here, working as a messenger for a brigade of Hook guerrillas in the mountains above Calamba. He spends Christmas Day in a fisherman's hut on the shores of the big lake, Laguna Dabai. There are plenty of mosquitoes. Another bout of malaria strikes him then. He spends 2 weeks, racked with fever dreams, having bizarre nightmares about Glory. Finally, he gets well enough to move again and hitches a boat ride into the lakeside town of Calamba. The black volcanoes that loom above it are a welcome sight. They look nice and cool, and they remind him of the ancestral Shafto territory. According to their family lore, the first Shaftos to come to America worked as indentured servants in tobacco and cotton fields, raising their eyes longingly towards those cool mountains as they stooped in sweltering fields. As soon as they could get away, they did, and headed uphill. The mountains of Luzon beckoned Shafto in the same way, away from the malarial lowlands, up towards Glory. His journey's almost over. But he gets stuck in Calamba, forced to hide in a boathouse when the city's Nipponese Air Force troops begin gathering their forces for some kind of a move. Those Hooks up on the mountain have been giving them a hard time, and the Nips are getting crazed and vicious. The leader of the local Hooks finally sends an emissary to get Shafto's story. The emissary goes away, and several days pass. Finally, a Phil-American lieutenant returns bearing 2 pieces of good news. The Americans have landed in force at Lingayen Gulf, and Glory is alive and working with the Hooks only a few miles away.
"Help me get out of this town," Shafto pleads. "Take me out in a boat on the lake. Drop me off in the countryside, then I can move."
"Move where?" says the lieutenant, playing stupid.
"To the high ground, to join those Hooks."
"You would be killed. The ground is booby-trapped. The Hooks are extremely vigilant."
"But
why don't you go the other way?" the lieutenant asks. "Go to Manila."
"Why would I want to go there?"
"Your son is there, and that is where you are needed. Soon the big battle will be in Manila."
"Okay,"
Shafto says.
"I'll go to Manila, but first I want to see Glory."
"Ah," the lieutenant says, as if light has finally dawned.
You say you want to see glory.
I'm not just saying it. I do want to see glory.
The lieutenant exhales a cloud of cigarette smoke and shakes his head.
No, you don't,
he says flatly.
What?
You don't want to see glory.
How can you say that? Are you fucking out of your mind?
The lieutenant's face goes stony.
Very well, he says. I will make inquiries. Perhaps glory will come here and visit you.
Well, that's crazy. It's much too dangerous.
The lieutenant laughs.
No, you don't understand, he says. You are a white man in a provincial city in the Philippines occupied by starving berserk nips. It is impossible for you to show your face outside. Impossible. Glory, on the other hand, is free to move.
You said they were inspecting people almost every block.
They will not bother Glory.
Do the nips ever, you know, molest women?
You are worried about Glory being raped.
The lieutenant takes another long draw on his cigarette.
I can assure you that this will not happen.
He rises to his feet, tired of the conversation.
Wait here, he says. Gather your strength for the Battle of Manila.
He walks out, leaving Shafto more frustrated than ever. 2 days later, the owner of the boathouse, who speaks very little English, shakes Shafto awake before sunrise. He beckons Shafto into a small boat and rows him out into the lake, then half a mile up the shore toward a sandbar. The dawn is just breaking over the other side of the big lake, illuminating planet-sized cumulus clouds. It's as if the biggest fuel dump in the whole world is being blown up in a sky diced into vast trapezoids by the linear contrails of American planes on dawn patrol. Glory is strolling out on the sandbar. He can't see her face because she is wrapped in a silk scarf, but he would know the shape of her body anywhere. She walks back and forth along the shore, letting the warm water of the lake lap against her bare feet. She is really loving that sunrise. She keeps her back turned to Shafto so that she can enjoy it. What a flirt. Shafto gets as hard as an oar. He pats his back pocket, making sure he's well stocked with I Shall Return condoms. It will be tricky bedding down with Glory on a sandbar with this old codger here, but maybe he can pay the guy to go out and exercise his back for an hour. The guy keeps looking over his shoulder to judge the distance to the sandbar. When they are about a stone's throw away, he sits up and ships the oars. They coast for a few yards and then come to a stop.
What are you doing?
Shafto asks. Then he heaves a sigh.
You want money?
He rubs his thumb and fingertips together.
Huh? Like that?
But the guy is just staring into his face with an expression as tough and stony as anything that Shafto has seen on 100 battlefields around the world. He waits for Shafto to shut up, then cocks his head and jerks it back in the direction of Glory. Shafto looks up at Glory, just as she's turning around to face him. She reaches up with club-like hands, all wrapped up in long strips of cloth like a mummy's, and paws the scarf away from her face. Or what used to be a face. Now it's just the front of her skull. Bobby Shafto breathes in deep and lets out a scream that can probably be heard in downtown Manila. The boatman casts an anxious look toward the town, then stands up, blocking Shafto's view as he's drawing in another breath. One of the oars is in his hands. Shafto is just cutting loose with another scream when the oar clocks him in the side of the head. The Primary. The sun has made a long, skidding crash landing along the Malay Peninsula, a few hundred kilometers west, breaking open and spilling its thermonuclear fuel over about half of the horizon, trailing out a wall of salmon and magenta clouds that have blown a gash all the way through the shell of the atmosphere and erupted into space. The mountain containing the crypt is just a charcoal shard against that backdrop. Randy is annoyed with the sunset for making it difficult to see the construction site.
By now, the scar in the cloud forest is mostly healed over, or at least some kind of green stuff has taken over the bare lipstick-colored mud. A few Goto engineering containers still glower in the color-distorting light of the mercury vapor lamps around the entrance, but most of them have either moved inside the crypt or gone back to Nippon. Randy can make out the headlights of one house-sized Goto truck winding down the road, probably filled with debris for another one of the Sultan's land reclamation projects. Sealed up in the plane's nose, Randy can actually look forward out his window and see that they are landing on the new runway, built partly on such fill. The buildings of downtown are streaks of blue-green light on either side of the plane, tiny black human figures frozen in them. A man with a phone clamped between his ear and his shoulder. A woman in a skirt, hugging a pile of books to her chest, but thinking about something far away. The view turns empty and indigo as the plane's nose tilts up for the landing. And then Randy's looking out over the Sulu Sea at dusk, where the Badhao's kite-sailed boats are scuttling into port from a day's fishing, hung all about with gutted stingrays, flying fresh shark's tails like flags. Not long ago, it was ridiculously exotic to him. But now he feels more at home here than he did in California. For Sultan-class passengers, everything happens with cinematic, quick-cut speed. The plane lands, a beautiful woman hands you your jacket, and you get off. The planes used by Asian airlines must have special chutes in the tail where flight attendants are ejected into the stratosphere on their 28th birthdays. Usually, there's someone waiting for a Sultan-class passenger. This evening, it's John Cantrell, still ponytailed but now clean-shaven. Eventually, the heat has its way with everyone. He's even taken to shaving the back of his neck, a good trick for shedding a couple of extra BTUs. Cantrell greets Randy with an awkward simultaneous handshake and one-armed hug body check maneuver.
"Good to see you, John," Randy says.
"You too, Randy,"
John says. And each man averts his eyes shyly.
"Who's where?" "Well, you and I are here in the airport. Abby checked into a hotel in downtown San Francisco for the duration."
"Good. I didn't think he was safe in that house by himself."
Cantrell looks provoked.
"Any particular reason? Have there been threats?"
"None that I know of. But it's hard to ignore the high number of vaguely terrifying people wrapped up in this."
"No victim, Abby. Beryl's flying back to SF from Amsterdam. Actually, she's probably there by now."
"I heard she was in Europe. Why?"
"Strange government shiz going on there. I'll tell you later."
"Where's Eb?"
"Eb has been holed up in the crypt for a week with his team, doing this kind of incredible D-Day-like push to finalize the biometric identification system. We won't bother him. Tom's been drifting back and forth between his house and the crypt. Run various kinds of torture tests on the internal crypt network systems. Probing the inner trust boundaries. That's where we're going now."
"To the inner trust boundaries?"
"No. Sorry, his house."
Cantrell shakes his head.
It's not the house I would build."
"I want to see it."
"His paranoia is getting just a little out of hand."
Hey, speaking of that...
Randy stops. He was about to tell Cantrell about Pontifex, but they are very close to the halal Dunkin' Donuts, and people are looking at them. There's no way of telling who might be listening.
"I'll tell you later."
Cantrell looks momentarily baffled and then grins wickedly.
"Good one."
"We have a car?"
"I borrowed Tom's car, his Humvee. Not one of those cushy civilian models, a real military one."
"Oh, that's great," Randy says. "Does it come complete with a big machine gun on the back?"
"He looked into it. He could certainly get a license to own one in Kinakuta, but his wife drew the line at having an actual heavy machine gun in their domicile."
"How about you? Where do you stand on this gun stuff?"
"I own them and know how to use them, as you are aware,"
Cantrell says. They are winding their way down a gauntlet of duty-free shops, really more of a duty-free shopping mall. Randy cannot figure out who actually buys all of these large bottles of liquor and expensive belts. What kind of blandly orgiastic lifestyle demands this particular selection of goods? In the time that's thus passed, Cantrell has evidently decided that a more thorough answer to Randy's gun question is merited.
But the more I practiced with them, the more scared I got. Or maybe depressed.
What do you mean? This is Randy in unaccustomed sounding board mode, psychotherapeutically prompting Cantrell for his feelings. It must have been a weird day for John Cantrell, and no doubt there are some feelings that need to be addressed.
Holding one of those things in your hands, cleaning the barrel and shoving the rounds into clips, really brings you face to face with what a desperate last-ditch measure they really are. I mean, if it gets to the point where we are shooting at people and vice versa, then we have completely screwed up. So in the end, they only strengthened my interest in making sure we could do without them.
And hence the crypt? Randy asks.
My involvement in the crypt is arguably a direct result of a very few bad dreams that I had about guns.
It is wonderfully healthy to be talking like this, but it is a portentous departure from their usual hardcore technical mode. They are wondering about whether it is even worth it for them to be mixed up in this stuff. Heedless certainty sure is easier.
Well, what about those secret admirers who are hanging around outside Ordo? Randy asks.
What about them? You're asking me about their state of mind?
Yeah, that is what we are talking about. States of mind.
Cantrell shrugs.
I don't know specifically who they were. I'd guess there are one or two honest-to-God scary fanatics. Setting them aside, maybe a third of them are just too young and immature to understand what's going on. It was just a lark for them. The other two-thirds probably had very sweaty palms.
They looked like they were trying awfully hard to keep up a cheerful front.
They were probably happy to get out of there and to go sit in a dark, cool room and drink beer afterwards. Certainly a lot of them have been sending me email about the crypt since then.
As an alternative to violent resistance to the United States government, I assume and hope you mean.
Exactly. Sure, I mean, that's what the crypt is becoming, right?
The question sounds a little querulous to Randy.
Right, he says.
He wonders why he feels so much more settled about this stuff than John Cantrell does, and then recalls that he has nothing left to lose. Randy takes one last breath of dry, machine-cooled air and holds it refreshingly in his lungs as they step out into the heat of the evening. He has learned to relax into the climate. You can't fight it. There is a humming logjam of black Mercedes Benzes waiting to pick up the Sultan and Vizier-class passengers. Very few Walla-class passengers get off at Kinakuta. Most of them are in transit to India. Because this is the kind of place where everything works just perfectly, Randy and John are in the Humvee about 20 seconds later and 20 seconds after that, driving at 120 kilometers per hour down a long horizontal shaft of ghastly blue-green freeway light.
We have been assuming that this Humvee is not bugged, Cantrell says. So if you were holding back on something, you can speak freely now.
Randy writes, "Let's stop assuming anything of the kind," on a notepad, and holds it up. Cantrell raises his eyebrows one notch, but of course does not seem especially surprised. He spends all of his time around people trying to outdo each other in paranoia. Randy writes, "We have been under surveillance by a former NSA hondo gone private." Then he adds, "Probably working for one or more crypt clients." "How do you know?" Cantrell mouths. Randy sighs, then writes, "I was contacted by a wizard." Then, as long as John's preoccupied with working his way around a left-lane fender bender, he adds, "Think of it as due diligence, underworld style." Cantrell says out loud,
"Tom has been pretty scrupulous about making sure his house is bug-free. I mean, he built the thing, or had it built, from the ground up."
He veers off onto an exit ramp and plunges into the jungle.
"Good. We can talk there," Randy says, then writes, "Remember the new U.S. embassy in Moscow? Bugs mixed into the concrete by KGB. Had to be torn down."
Cantrell grabs the pad and scribbles blind on the dashboard while maneuvering the Humvee up a curving mountain road into the cloud forest.
What do you want to talk about that is so secret? Arethusa? Give me agenda, please. Randy. 1. Lawsuit and whether Epiphyte can continue to exist. 2. That NSA Tapper and Wizard exist. 3. Maybe Arethusa. Cantrell grins and writes, I have good news. Tombstones, /. /, in this context, is Unix for the root of the file system, which in the case of Tombstone is synonymous with the hard drive that Randy tried to wipe. Randy raises his eyebrows skeptically, and Cantrell grins, nods, and draws his thumb across his throat. Shea Howard is a flat-roofed concrete structure that, from certain angles, looks like a very large drainage culvert set vertically in a mound of grout on the top of a foothill. It becomes visible from one of those angles about 10 minutes before they actually arrive, because the road must make several switchbacks across the broad slope of that foothill, which has been involuted and fractalized by relentless drainage. Even when it's not raining here, the mere condensation of moisture from the South Sea breezes gathers on leaves and rains from their drip tips all the time. Between the rain and the plant life, erosion must be a violent and ravenous force here, which makes Randy a little uneasy about all of these mountains, because mountains could only exist in such an environment if the underlying tectonic forces were thrusting rock into the air at a rate that would make your ears pop standing still. But then again, having just lost a house to a Tembler, he is naturally inclined to a conservative view. Cantrell is now drawing an elaborate diagram, and has even slowed down almost to a stop, the better to draw it. It begins with a tall rectangle. Set within that is a parallelogram, the same size but skewed a little bit downwards, and with a little circle drawn in the middle of one edge. Randy realizes he's looking at a perspective view of a doorframe with its door hanging slightly ajar, the little circle being its knob. Steel frame, Cantrell writes, hollow metal channels. Quick meandering scribbles suggest the matrix of wall surrounding it, and the floor underneath. Where the uprights of the doorframe are planted in the floor, Cantrell draws small, carefully foreshortened circles. Holes in the floor. Then he encircles the doorframe in a continuous hoop, beginning at one of those circles and climbing up one side of the doorframe, across the top, down the other side, through the other hole in the floor, and then horizontally beneath the door, then up through the first hole again, completing the loop. He draws one or two careful iterations of this, and then numerous sloppy ones until the whole thing is surrounded in a vague, elongated tornado. Many turns of fine wire. Finally, he draws two leads away from this huge door-sized coil and connects them to a sandwich of alternating long and short horizontal lines, which Randy recognizes as the symbol for a battery. The diagram is completed with a huge arrow drawn vigorously through the center of the doorway, like an airborne battering ram, labeled B, which means a magnetic field. Ordo computer room door.
Wow!
Randy says. Cantrell has drawn a classic elementary school electromagnet, the kind of thing young Randy made by winding a wire around a nail and hooking it up to a lantern battery. Except that this one is wound around the outside of a door frame and, Randy guesses, hidden inside the walls and beneath the floor so that no one would know it was there unless they tore the building apart. Magnetic fields are the styli of the modern world. They are what writes bits onto disks or wipes them away. The read-write heads of Tombstone's hard drive are exactly the same thing, but a lot smaller. If they are fine-pointed draftsman's pens, then what Cantrell's drawn here is a fire hose spraying India ink. It probably would have no effect on a disk drive that was a few meters away from it, but anything that was actually carried through that doorway would be wiped clean. Between the pulse gun fired into the building from outside, destroying every chip within range, and this doorframe hack, losing every bit on every disk, the Ordo raid must have been purely a scrap-hauling run for whoever organized it. Andrew Loeb, or, according to the secret admirers, Attorney General Comstock's sinister Fed forces who were using Andy as a cat's paw.
The only thing that would have made it through that doorway intact would have been information stored on CD-ROM or other non-magnetic media, and Tombstone had none of that. Finally, they have made it up to the top of the hill, which Tom Howard has shaved to the bedrock in a kind of monk's tonsure. Not because he hates living things, though he probably has no particular affection for them, but to hold at bay the forces of erosion and to create a defensive glacis across which the movements of incredibly poisonous snakes, squirrel-sized insects, opportunistic lower primates, and villainous upper primates will be visible on the array of video cameras he has built into fairly subtle recesses and crevices up on the walls. Seen up close, the house is surprisingly not as dour and fortress-like as it looked at first. It is not just a single large culvert, but a bundle of them in different diameters and lengths, like a faggot of bamboo. There is a decent number of windows, particularly on the north side where there's a view, down the slope that John and Randy have just climbed, to a crescent-shaped beach. The windows are set deeply into the walls, partly to back them out of the nearly vertical rays of the sun, and partly because each one has a retractable steel shutter hidden in the wall that can be dropped down in front of it. It is an okay house, and Randy wonders if Tom Howard would be willing to deed it over to the dentist and hawk his colossal suite of Gomer Ball-strewed furniture and move his family into a crowded apartment building just in order to retain control of Epiphyte Corporation. But maybe that won't even be necessary. John and Randy climb out of the Humvee to the sound of gunfire. Artificial light radiates upwards from a slot neatly dissected out of the jungle nearby. Humidity and clouds of insects make light a nearly solid and palpable thing here. John Cantrell leads Randy across the perfectly sterile parking slab and into a screened and fenced tunnel that has been stabbed into the black vegetation. Underfoot is some kind of black plastic grid that keeps the nude soil from becoming a glue trap. They walk down the tunnel until 20 or 30 paces later it opens up into an extremely long, narrow clearing, the source of the light. At the far end of it, the ground rises abruptly in a sort of berm, partly natural, Randy thinks, and partly enhanced with fill dirt excavated from the house's foundation. Two large paper targets in the shape of human silhouettes are clipped to a rack there. At the near end, two men with ear protectors pulled down around their necks are examining a gun. One of these men is Tom Howard. Randy is struck, but not really astonished, by the fact that the other one is Douglas MacArthur Shafto, evidently fresh in from Manila. The gun looks like exactly the same model that some of the black-hatted and bandana-masked posse were carrying yesterday in Los Altos, a long pipe with a sickle-shaped clip curving away from one side. Doug is in the middle of saying something and is not the type to interrupt his train of thought and fall all over himself being friendly just because Randy has recently traversed the Pacific Ocean.
"I never knew my father," he says. "My Filipino uncles used to tell me stories that he had told. When he was on Guadalcanal, the Marines, were still using their Springfields, the Ought-3 model, so 4 decades old, when finally the M1 rifle began to show up. So they took one of each rifle and tossed it into the water and rolled it around in the sand for a while and did God knows what else to it, but nothing that would be unusual in a real combat situation for a Marine. And then tried to operate them and found that the Ought-3 still worked and the M1 didn't. So they stuck to their Springfields. And I would say that some testing along those lines would be in order if you think you're really designing an insurgency weapon, as you say. Good evening, Randy."
"Doug, how are you?"
"I'm just fine, thank you."
Doug is one of these guys who always interprets "how are you" as a literal request for information, not just an empty formality, and always seems slightly touched that someone would care enough to ask.
"Mr. Howard here says that when you were sitting on top of that car typing, you were actually doing something clever and dangerous, at least from a legal point of view."
"Were you monitoring that?" Randy asks Tom.
"I saw packets moving through the crypt and later saw you on television. I put 2 and 2 together," Tom says. "Nice job, Randy."
He lumbers forward and shakes Randy's hand. This is an almost embarrassing outpouring of emotion by Tom Howard standards.
What I did there probably failed, Randy says. If Tombstone's disc was blanked, it was blanked by the doorframe coil and not by what I did.
Well, you deserve recognition anyway, which is what your friend is trying to give you,
Doug says, mildly irked at Randy's obtuseness.
I should offer you a drink and a chance to relax and all of that,
Tom says, looking towards his house.
But on the other hand, Doug says you were flying salting class.
Let's talk out here, Randy says. But actually, there is one thing you could get me.
What's that?
Tom asks. Randy pulls the little disembodied hard drive out of his pocket and holds it up in the light, the wire ribbon a-dangle. A laptop computer and a screwdriver?
Done,
Tom says, and disappears down the tunnel. Doug, meanwhile, begins dismantling the weapon, as if just to keep his hands busy. He takes the parts out one by one and regards them curiously.
What do you think of the heap gun?
Cantrell asks.
I don't think it is as crazy as when I first heard of it,
Doug says.
But if your friend Avi thinks that people are going to be able to manufacture rifled gun barrels in their basements to protect themselves against ethnic cleansing, he's got another think coming.
Rifled barrels are hard,
Cantrell says.
There's no way around it. They'd have to be stockpiled and smuggled. But the idea is that anyone who downloaded the heap and who had access to some basic machine tools could build the rest of the weapon.
I need to sit down with you sometime and explain everything else that's wrong with the idea,
Doug says. Randy changes the subject. How's Amy? Doug looks up and eyes Randy carefully.
You want my opinion? I think she is lonely and in need of reliable support and companionship.
Now that Doug has totally alienated both Randy and John, the gun range is completely silent for a while, which is probably how Doug likes it. Tom comes out with a laptop in one hand and, in the other, half a dozen blue plastic water bottles all shrink-wrapped together, already dribbling a trail of condensation.
I have an agenda,
Cantrell says, holding up the notepad.
Whoa! You guys are organized,
Tom says.
Item the first. Lawsuit and whether Epify can continue to exist.
Randy lays the laptop out on the same table where Doug is working with the heap gun and begins to remove screws.
I assume you guys know of the lawsuit and have worked out the implications of it yourself, he says.
If the dentist can prove that Doug discovered the wreck as a byproduct of work he did for us, and if the value of that wreck is high enough compared to the value of the company, then the dentist owns us, and for all practical purposes, owns the crypt.
Whoa, wait a minute. The Sultan owns the crypt,
Tom says.
If the dentist controls Epiphyte, all he gets out of it is a contract to provide certain technical services in the crypt.
Randy senses everyone's looking at him. He twirls screws out of the computer, refusing to agree with this.
Unless there's something here I'm not getting,
Tom says.
I guess I'm just being paranoid and sort of assuming that the dentist is somehow collaborating with forces in the U.S. government that are anti-privacy and anti-crypto,
Randy says.
Attorney General Comstock's cabal, in other words,
Tom says.
Yeah, for which I have never actually seen any evidence at all, but in the wake of the Ordo raid, everyone seems to be assuming it. If that is the case, and the dentist ends up providing technical services to the crypt, then the crypt is compromised. We have to assume in that case that Comstock has a man on the inside.
Not just Comstock,
Cantrell says.
Okay, the U.S. government.
Not just the U.S. government,
Cantrell says.
The Black Chamber. What the hell do you mean by that?
Doug asks.
There was a high-level conference a couple of weeks ago in Brussels, hastily organized, we think, chaired by Attorney General Comstock, representatives of all the G7 countries and a few others. We know people from the NSA were there, people from Internal Revenue, Treasury people, Secret Service, their counterparts in the other countries, and a lot of mathematicians known to have been co-opted by the government. The U.S. Vice President was there. Basically, we think that they are planning to form some kind of international body to clamp down on crypto and particularly on digital money.
The International Data Transfer Regulatory Organization,
Tom Howard says.
The Black Chamber is a nickname for that?
Doug asks.
That's what people on the Secret Admirers mailing list have started calling it,
Cantrell says. Why form this organization now? Randy wonders.
Because the crypt is about to go hot and they know it,
Cantrell says.
They are scared shitless about their ability to collect taxes when everyone is using systems like the crypt,
Tom explains to Doug.
This has been the talk of the Secret Admirers mailing list for the last week, and so when Ordo was raided, it really hit a raw nerve.
Okay, Randy says. I've been wondering why people showed up there almost immediately with guns and Stranger Things. He has got the laptop opened up now and disconnected its hard drive.
You have wandered off the agenda,
Doug says, pulling an oily rag down the barrel of the heap gun.
The question is, does the dentist have you guys by the balls or only by the short hairs? And that question basically revolves around yours truly, right?
Right, Randy says, a little too forcefully. He's feeling desperate for a change in subject.